Hi, this is Paul, and many of you will remember Warren Mills. Warren was my host for the Jordan Peterson conference that we had in Australia, and I spoke with him not too long ago about his first published book, How Good is the Golden Rule? And we talked about that before. And today we're going to talk a little bit about another book that he has written. Actually, he wrote that first and then did the Golden Rule book and then came back to this. And I've read about half of the book, and it is really a fascinating and lovely book about a topic that I had never given any thought to until I met Warren. So Warren, I really appreciate you taking the time and being with us. This third person is, who is Nikki again? Just in case people wonder who this Nikki Douglas is, Warren.
Nikki Douglas is my publisher here in Melbourne, and her business partner, Michael Murphy, was responsible for my first book. And really, she's been responsible for the second one, which I'd put aside as being, you know, a good try, but fail. And she liked it enough to encourage me. So I started working on the revision of that late last year. And it's very happily coincided with the lockdown. So I was able to spend a lot of time revising, and I've had lots of more insights into why I wrote it. That was really the key. And
Well, talk about that a little bit, because in previous videos, and I'll link those previous videos that we've had, I mean, you told a bit of your story, you know, in the lingo of Australia, you're a petrol head. And so talk about why you wrote the book in the first place, and then what changed so that you really, and you know, began to rework it?
Yeah, my motivation for writing initially was that I was part of a men's Bible study group, a small group, in the home of Stan and Gigi Hankins from North Carolina. He was a great guy, and I really enjoyed his hosting and the fellowship of these guys. We had quite a few in that time. And so we started doing the ordinary things that you do in small groups. You know, we did Alpha and a few things like that. And we started becoming a bit broader and more philosophical in our discussion. And I remember a particular incident where I quoted the scripture that says, some of you cross land and sea to win converts and turn them into bigger devils than yourselves. And the group was astounded that that could appear in scripture. So I went away, did some work, and, you know, got the references and started to do some writing. And so then the writing just sort of kept going. That happily coincided with my partial retirement, and I knew I had a book in me because I'd first planned it about 40 years ago, a long time ago, and I kept my original notes about what this book should be about, and so I thought then that it could be about my lifelong hero, whose name is Big Daddy Don Garlitz, who's an American drag racer. And I'd followed him since I was about 12, literally, when I bought a hot rod magazine with my vacation pocket money. And I was fascinated by this guy who was an underdog, and Australians love underdogs, because he was from the swamps of Florida. And he would drive across the continent to compete in California, where the action was. And he beat them and take home all of the money. And he did it with a car he designed and built himself. And it was an awful machine. It was just an old Chevrolet frame with a Chrysler hemispherical V8 in it. And anyway, that really captured my imagination, his tough grittiness and his innovation. And so he kept on winning from the mid-50s, when I first became aware of him, or late 50s, I guess, until he retired from open competition, I guess, in the late 80s. And so I found his email and sent him a message and proposed that I would do this story about his spirituality, because mid-career he put the cross on his car and the words "God is love," and he never explained it, at least not to my satisfaction, and we didn't have YouTube in those days. So anyway, he encouraged me and he thought it was a great idea, so I started to write, and I shared bits and pieces with my men's group, and a lot of it actually came out of the discussion with them. And from that, my Bunch of Blokes project was born, which I've mentioned before. And I finished the book and submitted it to HarperCollins with a very good introduction from Julian Clark, my mate, who was at the time the head of News Corp Australia, and HarperCollins is part of their stable, and they thought it was rubbish. So I was severely chastened by that, and it was too, really. It was, as I said before, maybe a good first attempt, but not good enough. So I parked it, and then I did my Golden Rule book, which we launched in March last year. And I must say that the response to that has been disappointing. And so I guess that's the problem that all people like me have. You've mentioned pastors with unpublished books, or books of which they've sold 100 copies.
Mostly to their church and family.
Yeah. Well, there's one person that's bought a lot of this book, How Good is the Golden Rule? And it's me. I have got some readership in Italy, though, and other places that I know nothing about, and it's available on Amazon, so who knows. But it seems as though everyone takes the Golden Rule for granted. They say, oh, of course, yes, that's what you have to do. You've got to treat others as you'd like to be treated, and love your enemies. And it sort of stops there. You know, it's part of the liturgy that we say every Sunday in church. And I remarked in the book, actually, that I did some search to find previous books and sermons on the Golden Rule, and there's very few. It has been significant in different places at different times, but it seems as though it's hard to generate any interest in taking it seriously as a discipline, that we actually consciously and purposefully implement in our lives. Because what I've learned, and the reason why I think it's significant, why significant to me, is that when you do it, when you start to try and apply it in a serious and consistent way, you realize that you can't do it, and that it defeats us, and that we're actually hypocrites. And what we really want most of the time is for people to do to us what we want.
Right.
And we dress it up in the clothes of the Golden Rule, but actually we're only kidding ourselves. And so that's where the charge of hypocrisy comes from, which is often, I think, well earned. And so I've taken that as a salutary lesson, and I've revised that book as well, and I've called it The Golden Rule, a panacea for every pandemic. Which is a bit opportunistic, I know. But, and I've changed the introduction and the conclusion to the book a lot. And that's come about both as a result of, you know, the apparent lack of success over the last year, but also as a result of my writing the Garlitz book. I realized that the Garlitz book is really about me and this whole thing of hero worship. And I've discovered a very well-established theory called mimetic theory by René Girard, whose name I learned from you. And the mimetic theory is that we learn from others by mimicking them. Of course, that's what an infant does. Mm-hmm. Mimics its parents and then its siblings and friends, and that's why little kids develop accents that their parents don't possess. and so this whole thing about learning from our peers, from our surroundings, is a very important insight, but I think it's got to do ultimately with what we desire. And so we form these desires as a result of all sorts of unseen forces in our lives, and then they perhaps sort of manifest in a person, in an individual who we idealize, and we consciously or unconsciously want to be like them. And that's the influence that Garlitz has had on me all my life. And so I visited him with my friend Eugene Kneebone, and he shocked me because he'd already warned me that I'd made him into something that he wasn't. And so his lack of pretension and his brutal honesty was really a surprise. But that's one of the insights, I think, of the book, that he's a no bullshit guy.
Well, let's talk about really, you know, I really appreciate that, you know, you've worked Girard in and this this hero worship and idealization. Why do you think, I mean, at a very young age, Garlitz got your attention? What about him really struck you? Because it wasn't just, I was watching a show on Netflix about a year or so ago where people were racing supercars against the cars that they were putting together, you know, in their garage from their pieces and stuff. And of course, the premise of the show is you want the little guy who puts the car together out of stuff that he finds. And yeah, he's putting some money into that car, but he doesn't have a lot of money. That compared to the racer who has the big money, can buy the six-figure the Lamborghini or the Ferrari, and just, you know, tuned by the professionals. So talk a little bit more about Garlitz and then probably go a little bit into, you know, his faith and how that formed. And I like the way you told it, how mysteriously suddenly there's a cross and God is love on his car. Tell me about that.
Yeah. I think the interest, first of all, it has got to do with the Australian pioneer spirit. And that's shared, I think, with Americans who came into this apparently big, open, unclaimed land. We know that's not the case, but that's how we took advantage of it. And we had to make do with bits of fencing wire to tie things up and repair wagons. And so that idea, there was another thing too in Australia. I'm not sure if you had this in America, but if you go into country towns, you'll see mechanics institutes everywhere. And they're old, quite grand buildings in some cases, now disused or repurposed. And so I guess they were built in the late 19th century. And they housed a library of all of the latest technology, you know, engineering stuff and how to make machines and make models of machines. And so it was this very virulent, spreading of the new technology of engineering through books and libraries, and people going to their sheds and building machines from principles that they had just learned from a book. So I think you see that in the you know, the explosion of creativity with people like Henry Ford and the Chevrolet brothers and Dodge brothers, I think they were, and of course the Wright brothers, and there was so many others at that time, often who had previously been buggy makers or bicycle repairers or bicycle makers, and they jumped on the bandwagon and started building cars. Well, that's really inspired me to be able, because I had a lot of those basic engineering skills that I gained as a teenager at home, and then later in the work that I did when I started work as an engineering research technician. And so I had all these capabilities, and I could see what other people did with those things. And Garlett sort of he sort of manifest this spirit of making, because the idea of a hot rod is to take something old and to lighten it, to simplify it, to increase its power and make it perform like something new. And so drag racing is that just taken to its logical conclusion. Well, he was the master of it, and he and his brother were hot rodders and street racers, and then they got bitten by the competition bug and started turning their hot rods into drag racing machines that didn't drive on the road. And of course that was the process of evolution. And then Garlitz went through a couple of relationships where he was, in one case, about to be engaged to a girl, but she didn't like the job, the idea that he'd given up his job as an accountant to become a mechanic because he had dirty hands. And so that was the end of that engagement. And then he met his wife, Patricia, who he was completely head over heels in love with, and he gave up hot rodding for her. But she obviously knew that the passion still burned and encouraged him to get back into the sport, which he did with a streetcar. And then, of course, the evolution took hold and she encouraged him. Well, he, by his own confession, had gone forward in a Baptist church service that he'd attended as a teenager, but it was more initially in pursuit of the pastor's daughter. But then he met Pat, who was a Christian and came from a Christian home, and she managed to bridge the two cultures, you know, a faithful Christian on one hand and this wild-eyed hot rodder on the other. And she obviously She was a very capable person and obviously really loved his creativity and his focus and his energy. And so she encouraged him. And initially, when they were first married, she would travel with him to these events all across America, in California in particular, but into the Midwest, and because it really, the sport really exploded. And she was responsible for a lot of his innovations because she was concerned for his safety and would do things like buy him a leather jacket when everybody raced in a t-shirt. And that was immediately before he was using a supercharger for the first time, and the engine was in front of the driver and running on nitromethane. He created the potential for an explosion, which is exactly what happened, and he was sitting in an inferno, and he'd only just started to wear this leather jacket that Pat had given him. Well, that sort of tension between encouraging him and restraining him happened throughout their life. And it culminated in him running for a championship event in Long Beach. And he was on the starting line. His car for the eliminator, this is the last run of the day, the two cars against each other. The car had an experimental transmission in it, and he'd had to service it during the rounds and didn't have time to fill it properly with oil. So he ran it only partly filled with oil, and the transmission exploded on the start line and cut the car completely in half, and it took half of his right foot with it. So he ended up in hospital in Long Beach, and he refused to take painkillers because after his previous experience of being badly burned, he hated the idea of becoming dependent on painkillers, so he just refused them. And so they refused to attend to him during the night and change his bedclothes and his pajamas that would become saturated with sweat. And so in the midst of this agony, he recalls that he called out to God, and the sense of God's presence came into the room. The pain went away, never came back. And so it was while he was recovering from that that he reconfigured the design of his car in his mind so that the engine was behind the driver, which had been tried unsuccessfully before. But he decided that the risk wasn't worth it, and even if that was a disadvantage, that's what he was going to do. So he, upon returning to Florida, built this new car. But as everybody predicted, they couldn't get it to run straight. And at the end of the drag strip at top speed, it would be unpredictable as to which way it would deviate. And so everybody said that these cars were ill-fated, that was a fault that you couldn't fix. And it was really Pat who made him persist. And she said, don't risk your life, and just get back to it and apply yourself to the task, you'll solve it. And it was his fabricator who realized what the problem was, and it was to do with the fact that the driver was now sort of much closer to the front axle than he was before, and he was overreacting. And so he was oversteering, overcorrecting. And so they made a new steering arm for the car to reduce the ratio, and that fixed the problem. And so he turned up at the next major event with the car, and everybody ridiculed it. And but it was successful, and within a year, almost all of the top fuel cars had been now conformed to this rear engine design. And so then, a while later, I guess I forget the exact time, but some 3 or 4 years, maybe more later, he was building a new car with sponsorship from the Navy, who wanted it painted blue instead of black. And the car was sitting in the workshop, freshly painted, and he was in the workshop at the end of the day by himself looking at the car, and he visualized a cross on the cowl with the words "God is love." And so that's what he did. He painted it on the car and then turned up to the next major event, all ready for the new sponsorship from the Navy, to the ridicule of everybody, including the press and his competitors, and people were saying he's looking for sponsorship from the Sky Daddy and things like that. And the Navy said, well, we can't continue if you leave the cross and the words "God is love" on the car. So he said, that's fine with me. And he points out that that was the most successful car in terms of prize money that he ever had. And he won something like $600,000 from that one car without sponsorship in the next 18 months or so. And so then that motif stuck. But he didn't bother explaining it too much. I guess he might have here and there. And he wrote a book quite early in the piece called Close Calls. And he sort of alluded to it, but it wasn't explicit. You know, it wasn't laying out his experience as a Christian and things like that. But initially it was a tribute to his wife, really, but he's attributing God with the insights and the innovations that he made to resolve this tension between taking a risk and winning races and earning money and keeping safe. And so I was always fascinated by that, and when I started writing the book, I saw a clip on YouTube about him sitting with Pat talking about his experience at Long Beach and then building the rear engine car. And so that really galvanized what I wanted to say, because I think that he was addressing some of the real challenges of making faith relevant in everyday life, that wasn't just using religious words and playing the religious game by going to church and appearing to be a religious, righteous person. He didn't do that at all, and he went to church, and he often talked about praying, and he and Pat would pray together, and extraordinary things happened when they did, and he acknowledged that. But he wasn't religious in the ordinary sense at all, and so that was the big shock for me when I turned up in Florida to interview him. And he had some surprises in store for me, to really put that notion about him being some sort of sanctimonious religious person to rest.
What? The video I'm working on right now, and I said this in an earlier conversation I did today, because I always warn that the videos I'm working on might not always see the light of day. But I'm working on David Putnam's book, American Grace, where he notes the polarization in the American, both in the American political sphere over religion. And this is a dramatic change from the situation during the Cold War. And they try to come to grips with this dynamic via religiosity. Scarlet's, it sounds like, is an interesting mix of religiosity, because obviously spurning a potential sponsor by putting a cross and God is love on a car seems religious, but then other aspects of his life don't look religious, even though, as you know, you dug into his story, saw that he is deeply religious. What are some of the ways that he resisted sanctimony? It's usually sanctimony that catches people's attention and deeply turns them off.
That's a really interesting puzzle for me and Eugene Kneebone, who went with me, and David Wright, who is my co-developer of Bunch of Blokes, who understands the American culture very well, because he lived in Colorado for 10 years as the president of Youth for Christ. And he thinks I'm barking up the wrong tree. And he says that, I guess he's saying that Galitz has pulled the ultimate contrary of claiming some sort of spirituality or religiosity at a certain level, but ignoring it for the rest of his life. And so I think that's wrong. And the shocking thing about Galitz is that he talks about garage talk or locker room talk. And sometimes he falls into it too. And that's a shock, because Christians, as a rule, are very careful about their words. And I'm the same, you know. I occasionally use bad language for effect. But if someone else does it, I'm always shocked by it and I'm offended. But he doesn't care. And I'm not approving that, but I'm just saying, here's how it really is. This is how he is, and he admits some tension, but you've got to push him to talk about it and to try and sort of make it conscious, and so. I don't think he's being opportunistic, or of course he grew up in a religious atmosphere where it was expected that you'd go to church and Sunday school and things like that, and that being saved was part of what you did, and so that's an influence. But it's really Pat who with her consistent faith and that playing out in her life and her relationship with him and with their daughters and I guess her witness to him, that he's convinced that this is an absolute reality. And so he's seeing realities that other people aren't. And so I think even religious people sometimes take on, you know, the gloss of religion, but it's superficial and it's not deeply rooted. I've been guilty of that for a significant part of my life, and it really is hypocritical. And so, by the way, Garlitz is also interested in extraterrestrials and UFOs, and he's not ashamed of that at all either. And that's outside my league, but that's just the way it is. And so I'm saying there's a tension to resolve here, and above all else, we ought to resolve it on the side of being honest. Now, I was deeply impressed with my first encounter with Jordan Peterson about exactly that, the whole idea of the logos, of telling the truth, and being able to do that regardless of the consequences, that we had to do it. And so I guess in a way it's playing that out and taking that to its logical conclusion and saying, well, Don Garlitz is an ordinary sinner, and so am I. And ultimately, we're dependent on God's mercy. And so we're just going to get on with our life and do what we do, make our mistakes, not wear them on our sleeve necessarily, but like Martin Luther says, sin boldly, but love Christ all the more.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned you rewrote the book. What prompted, because again, you first turned it in, HarperCollins didn't want to have anything to do with it. You wrote the Golden Rule book, but then you said, you know, something happened in you, and tell me about that. What changed to make the book a better book from the first one that you wrote?
I guess it was the insight that the Golden Rule is really intended for us to learn about ourselves. And so, of course, it sets up the goal of treating other people well and being under God's scrutiny, being accountable to God, because that's part of the formula. But the real outcome of applying it seriously is that we start to learn about ourselves. We get some insights into our motivations and to our character, and what do we do when we find ourselves making the same mistake over and again? Well, with that insight, I started to see more clearly about my interest in Garlitz. Of course, the book's there, and it's for all intents and purposes finished, but not really able to be published. And so why did I write it? And, you know, am I trying to make something religious out of a very ordinary obsession? Or does it contain some sort of insight that I haven't really been able to bring to my consciousness and articulate? And so I think when I started to, over the years, I'd made several notes and I'd retitled it and had some attempts at trying to reframe the argument of the book. But when I started to write it, that coincided with me hearing you talk about René Girard, and so I started to do some investigation there, and slowly the picture became clear about mimetic theory and hero worship and scapegoating and all of that's implied by Girard's theory. And so I've never seen anyone write quite like this. But it seemed to hang together as a story. Incidentally, it's really been confirmed by Mike Lewis, who's the vice president of Don Schumacher Racing, which is one of the biggest drag racing teams in America. And he's a good guy. He's a Christian guy and runs a very smooth operation, you know, huge sponsorship dollars. And he's reading an earlier manuscript of the Garlitz book, and he says, "Oh, this is fantastic. This is going to be a bestseller." He might be the only person in the world that likes it, but I don't care, because he's got deep insights into the sport and Garlitz. He knows him personally. In fact, it was Garlitz who introduced me to him. And so he sees the resolution of this tension, and he's absolutely loving it and is making some suggestions as to how to improve it, and some of its technical detail, but some of its insights that he's had too. Mm. So I'm encouraged by that. And on another level, it's just me taking on a new career at age 74 or whatever I am, and being, you know, a creator, just making stuff, using my imagination, overlaying that with my experience, being a contrarian, liking to think differently and disagree with people. But I do think that I've tapped a vein, which is to some degree why Jesus preferred to deal with prostitutes and publicans, because they are real people. Mm-hmm. and he condemned the Pharisees and the people who cross land and sea to win converts and make them into bigger devils than themselves. Mm-hmm. And so I find that a really fascinating tension, and then to try and understand it, see how it applies in my life, and then to tell the story through, you know, the character of Don Garlitz, seems like something worth doing.
Mm-hmm. There's a great quote in the book from Don Garlitz: "Character determines how far you will go and whether you will still like yourself when you get there." But talk about that. What do you think he means?
He's obsessively competitive, and he was well known for being parsimonious, a penny pinching, and he was accused of that. And of course, in the early days of the sport, it was almost completely amateur, and the national events where you got the headlines, there was almost no prize money. It was a trophy, and you know, and enough to buy a hamburger, but that was about it. And so to make a living, they would do what they called match racing, which was to turn up to small country drag strips and run against another top-line competitor like Tommy Iver or Chris Karamassinis or Shirley Muldowney. So Shirley Muldowney and Garlitz were perennial competitors, and they were always putting each other down. But of course, it got people to attend. And so that was what you had to do to to make a living out of drag racing. And I guess Gallitz is observing in himself what happens when you take something to its logical conclusion, whether it's being a competitor or just in it for the money or whatever it is that you have developed as your shtick. What happens to you when you're successful doing that? And are you changed as a person? Is your life enhanced or is it depreciated? He probably didn't use exactly those words, but I think that's what he was getting at.
Yeah. Well, I think about that. You know, I think about that in terms of Jordan Peterson's story, and if he will, you know, if he what comes with the second book, because, you know, for him, fame was rather accidental when he was making noise about C16, even though, you know, being on Ontario Public Television and such, he did everything possible to become famous, and a lot of that just really didn't work. And then when he does something which was deeply himself and deeply unpopular, suddenly becomes tremendously famous. Well, now suddenly, you know, there's the real test. There's the real test. And, you know, you and I have spoken before too about, I often think about Peterson and compare him with someone like Billy Graham. One of the qualities that was enduring for Billy Graham was that it didn't seem, while that level of fame, observation wrecked a lot of Christian leaders, it never took down Graham. He certainly had his stumbles sometimes, especially with, in terms of relationships with presidents such as Richard Nixon.
Yeah.
But that's a big thing to become a legend, even in a legend in a sport, and not lose yourself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You can see it all the time, and especially amongst religious leaders. I mean, it's inconceivable that people like Bill Hybels and others like him have failed so spectacularly. And there's others like Jimmy Swaggart, and there's plenty of them, isn't there? And it's seduction, and it's our failure to recalibrate, is a term I like, to go back to what you say is purpose and meaning, and to say, why am I really doing this? And what am I trying to achieve? And am I fulfilling my goal? What does success mean? And I can be successful in terms of money, sex, and power, but is that really what I want? And so I think that's the essential question that Jesus asks of us. And he's saying to us continually, what's important? And I think that the whole idea, and you've touched on this a bit too with your discussion about communion and transubstantiation and taking on the body and blood of Christ. I've seen that in a new light too, particularly as a result of my experience at being at St. James, where it's traditional and liturgical, and we have communion every Sunday, which is served to us by the clergy. And I've got a new appreciation for the solemnity and the seriousness that implies, that we're taking Christ's blood and body into ourselves and becoming like him. And that's the goal of being human, to return to our first condition of being made in the image of God. And of course, the image of God that we're becoming like is Jesus. Mm-hmm. And so I just think that that's just wonderful. And so I guess being able to understand the theory from Scripture and Paul's teaching in particular, and mesh that with the experience of being uncompromisingly honest with yourself is the task. And I think it provides a vision, a foretaste of what's to come.
I've peppered you with questions. Anything that you wish we'd have touched on, or anything you want to touch on?
No. You keep on feeding me. You're a long way ahead of me. And I try to watch bits of everything that you do, and I pick up morsels here and there, and I'm really fascinated with the discussion with Eric Weinstein and Peter Thiel and people like that, and what they're attempting. And I haven't quite understood what you're getting out of them. But what it does to me is to bring me back to the elements of faith, hope, and love, and how different they are from wrestling with the ordinary problems of life, the material things. And making them central. And you can't contrive them, can you? You can just see them when they emerge, I think, as a result of our obedience. And so I'm being dragged along by your coattails, as it were. And I'm not in a position to attempt to keep up with where your mind and your discussions take you, but just to observe them and see where they fit, and then to take from it the things that seem to enhance and to fit with what I'm doing.
I don't think, you know, one of the things that, you know, I'm working on right now is the question of religiosity. And I was listening to Eric's conversation with a young man who's a writer, and he's been writing about Stoicism. And part of the, and I think this pertains to the Garlitz book, because you'd say, well, okay, so here you have a drag racer who's got some rough edges. You know, he's tremendously competitive, doesn't suffer losing very well. No. You know, he's got some fun ideas about UFOs, has had some real close calls with death, clearly has a very godly wife whose influence has molded him and shaped him. You know, you have to ask, and this is where, you know, some of my formation amongst the Dutch Calvinism has come from, because there's always this tension in Dutch Calvinism between the antithesis, which emphasizes redeemed and unredeemed, and then the common grace, which says that Christ looks over drag racing and claims ownership of it too. And that in there's something sacramental about taking cars from the 30s and buying an engine from a junker and figuring out exactly how this works so that you can do something which seems completely pointless. You're not going to the movie theater in this car. You're not driving to work. The only place you can really run these cars is, you know, in a straight line down a track in front of everybody who just wants to get from one end to the other quicker. Mm. And somehow this bears witness to Christ. And in a way that the cross and the words on the hood do, but even without those, it does so too. You know, what would Jesus Christ have to do with drag racing?
And
it gets into what I think, and you know, you sent me some things from John Milbank, and I still have to, I'm sort of approaching him at the edges right now, but it's getting into what I think is the attempt to re put together the two streams of Western thinking. You know, they were kind of divorced so that via science we could understand the world better, and via science you can tune that engine and understand the physics of the frame and all of that, but it has to be put back together with the other. And in Garlitz's unique way, he does this without, you know, knowing anything about Thomas Aquinas and transubstantiation, but in a strange way,
yeah,
he is working something sacramental,
yeah,
in the hot rod.
Yeah, and that's right.
Yeah,
it's re-enchanting.
Yes, it is.
And I reckon that the coronavirus is the perfect opportunity to reassess all of the things that we've been pursuing for a long time. You know, Australia's had almost 30 years of continuous growth, and we've become a wealthy nation. But I'm not sure we're better off. And so I've written a paper actually that talks about whether or not continual growth is a good thing or not, and I conclude that it's not, and that we should have other measures of progress rather than just growth in gross domestic product, for instance, because it perverts everything. It perverts the value, because the only real value that we'll find in life is with each other, and then eventually with our accountability to God, which is what the whole which is what the golden rule is about. And so I'm not sure how to do that, but I'm completely convinced that we need to do it, and we need to have new language. So I've got really no idea where to begin, other than to criticize what we've defined as success. And so it's, again, getting back to the Garlitz observation, and to say, well, okay, we've achieved that. Has it given us what we want? Is it really satisfying? Is it really fulfilling? Does it in any way resemble us being transformed into the image of Christ? And the answer is no. And so now we need to So I'm not trying to bring the kingdom on necessarily, because I think that that won't happen until the end of this age and in the age to come. But I think we can do much better by valuing people more than things, and by seeing real value in something other than money.
Well, well said, well said. Well, I think that's what I've got. And
well, just before I go, I see Nikki's name up there. She will want me to ask people to just make a comment as to their interest in this book, which is called Don Garlitz, The Enigmatic Hero. And so we're not quite sure when it will be available. We've still got to resolve some issues with regard to who's the publisher and where it's printed and things like that. Most likely it'll be printed in the USA, because that's where the big market is. But we would love to hear from people who think that that might be significant to them, that they might be interested in it, or those who think it's all rubbish and we ought to just get back to, you know, being religious.
Well, we'll I will post this on Friday, and and I think we'll see. Well, I don't have any. I mean, I don't know that my audience necessarily is in alignment. So you'll have to figure out how to work your network to get it in front of other people and to get those questions out there. So we'll see what the YouTube algorithm does, and I'll post it on Twitter. But we'll see what kind of good feedback we can get for you. But I really want this, you know, I'd like your Golden Rule book to succeed too, because the central insight of your book, I think, is absolutely correct. Mm. That people continually imagine that the Golden Rule is somehow some qualification. And you're exactly right that this is how we want other people to treat us. Mm. But the fact that this is in fact a tool of discipleship and sanctification, which is designed to show us who we are and where we need to go, I think is the heart of your book and deserves to be read. But I also think I like this other book too, and I think you're right that Australians and Americans both have a heart for the underdog and a heart for someone who reclaims parts from a junkyard and retains his character sufficiently so that after he's wealthy and famous, he still likes himself. So I think that's all good.
Anyway, Paul, it's just a wonderful journey and a wonderful adventure, and I'm so glad to be part of your audience, and I find you to be a constant inspiration and encouragement, and I just want to say thanks.
Well, thank you, and the feeling's mutual. I just told my wife this morning, I say, I'm talking to Warren, and she's like, oh, every time you mention his name, I think of Australia and such wonderful memories. And
so, that's great. Yeah.
So, all right, well, take care. And like I said, I'll publish this on Friday. And, and those who are watching this, if you know someone who might like the subject, forward the video and get the questions out there, and we'll see what kind of feedback we can get for Warren and Nikki.
Yeah. Good on you.
Super.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank you, Warren.
See ya.
Thank you, Nikki.
Bye.
Bye-bye.